House Committee on Judiciary, Subcommittee on Civil Law and Judicial Administration, Thursday, April 11th, 1991, 1 p.m., hearing room 357, public hearing and possible work session.
Ready or not, we're going to go ahead and convene the House Committee of Judiciary, Subcommittee on Civil Law and Judicial Administration. I'd like to extend a warm welcome to the distinguished crowd, referring to those in the back of the room. not necessarily a mob, but this group of politicians. We better open up a public hearing on House Bill 2837 and House Bill 2780 in order to accommodate Representative Repine, whom we're always seeking anxiously to take care of at all points of the process. We're glad to have at least one token Democrat in the room today. Representative Roberts is here as that representative, and we appreciate you coming. Representative Markham, Representative Schroeder, Representative Parks, who's usually here but at other subcommittee times, Representative Pickard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would like to say I'm here because my chairman twisted my arm and told me I better get down here, so that's why I'm the token.
Well, we're certainly glad to have you. It's always a privilege to have a Democrat on the right side of an issue for once. Moving right along. Move ahead. Oh, Representative, who would like to lead off? Mr. Markham, would you shally forth? Mr. Pro Tem Speaker.
Chairman, members of committee, Markham, District 46, it's a pleasure to be here. Our group here would really prefer to play to a full house. I wish you'd exercise a little discipline on the Democrats in particular, but I realize you're, well, anyway. This is a very simplistic little bill, and we don't want to make it too complex considering the people are sitting here listening to it, so let's not get it too mixed up. This little hummer came from a number of older people that have contacted me over the last two or three years and said that when they receive their notice of jury duty, it tends to make them doggone nervous. And they sit around and stew about whether they're going to get called the next week or the following week or until the whole, what do you call that, a jury what?
Pool.
Pool. Yeah. And until that session's over, and they just don't like it, and they want to know if they could be exempt if they were 65 years or older. And I drafted the bill. I said, would you settle for 70? Well, three of these people were over 80, as a matter of fact. One of them was 68 or something like that, and they thought this was a good idea, and that's the reason I put in the 70. Now, there isn't a heck of a lot more I can say about it. It's self-explanatory, and it literally says if you're 70 and older, you have the volition to choose not to serve if you care not to. And I'm speaking here, if he's not behind me now, for Bill Linden. What's his title?
State Administrator.
And he's in accord. I want you to hear this. He's in accord with the bill. So pass that. I'll move it over to anybody else you want to.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm Representative Lonnie Roberts from House District 21 in East Multnomah County. I'm more or less here as a me too. I think it's a good concept. Some of our citizens, the 70 and older, oftentimes are in ill health or they can be confused. And I think it not only helps them, but helps the judicial system itself. If you have someone in that condition, I'm sure that most of the time they're going to be challenged anyway. So rather than go put these folks through all of that kind of treatment, I think it's a prudent bill to allow those of our citizens 70 and older to, by their own decision, to excuse themselves from jury duty. And I think it's a service that, you know, it's not going to hurt the system, but I think it's going to help some of our citizens that need the help most.
Thank you, Representative Roberts.
Representative Schroeder. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Walt Schroeder from Coosan Curry County. I support the bill primarily because it's completely voluntary. This does not eliminate anybody who is 70 years or older from serving on jury, but it gives them the option of getting out if they wish to. I'm reminded of the story about a friend of mine who retired at about age 70. And he was asked, well, now, Frank, now that you have all this time, what are you going to fill your time with? He says, I don't have to worry about that. I'll spend half my time trying to remember people's names and the other half looking for restrooms. Thank you.
That's rather pertinent, I think.
Representative Pickard.
Bob Pickard, State Representative, District 54. It occurs to me, in support of this bill, that if one has lived on this planet for 70 years, they have earned the right to make some choices, and we think of retirement as being a time of maybe more freedom of choices. And this fits into that theme of having the choice. I know people who are 70 who would look forward to serving on a jury. I know others who would find it very unpleasant. The idea of having a choice is attractive to me, and that's why I'm supporting the bill.
Thank you, Representative Picker. We appreciate that. Representative Parks, we're always glad to have you as a member of Civil Sub.
I just speak for, briefly as one who spends a lot of time with jurors. The way it is now, you get a disproportionate amount of people over 70 because a lot of people, such as teachers, are excused during the year, and a lot of other folks have compelling reasons. And frankly, a lot of people over 70 don't want to put themselves in the position of having to tell the judge they can't hear or other physical disabilities. And I think this is a good compromise to allow those who want to serve, and there are a lot of them, and they're very good, to be able to go ahead and serve, and to allow those who know their own limitations to inform the judge, and just as a matter of courtesy, to be excused. So I support the bill.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Representative Parker. Representative Johnson, what are you doing out there?
Representative Rod Johnson from District 45. Good bill, should pass.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That was important input. All of it. Important.
Got an amendment?
Oh, Representative Van Leeuwen. We should have had you go first, dear.
For the record, I'm Representative Liz Van Leeuwen from House District 37, and I signed on to this bill because of what's happened to some of my neighbors since we changed the way that some of these people are chosen. And one of the first things that happened, a little elderly widow neighbor lady came driving over to my house. She just didn't know what to do with herself. She's close to 70-some, somewhere between 70 and 80, and so I had to go through the process of getting her excused from jury duty because she just did not know how to handle it. And I'm very much in support of this bill, and there are lots of us who are climbing up to that age who maybe would like to serve on jury duty, so I hope to pass the bill.
Thank you, Representative Van Leeuwen. Representative Repine, would you like to comment on this and also 2780?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Representative Baker. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the records, Representative Bob Repine from Josephine County, District 49. Actually, the amendment that Representative Markham has offered up was an interesting one. I have a bill that we'll talk about in a little later on here that I had that similar language built in, but I was having a difficult time how to make it look like I wasn't discriminating against our seniors, but in reality, it was to try to relieve them of that potential responsibility. And so I think it's a good bill. I know in the case of my parents particularly, they are over that age and would like to not have to worry about the fear of that having to justify how they would have to get there. And the other, when you get senior citizens, they kind of rely heavier on their counterparts. And there's a certain fear that goes along with that, and I think it would be good for the citizens to maybe release them of that responsibility if it is their choice.
Thank you. Anything on 2780?
2780. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the bill I had just mentioned that I had that kind of language in, and I took it out. Basically, what this bill addresses is two issues. One is the fact to extend the list that is kept for eligible jurors at the clerk's office from 24 months to 48. The reason behind that is since we've used the driver's licensing and voter registration as a combined way of getting names for the list, we should have a larger group of people to draw from now, and I think we should be able to extend the pleasure of serving on jury duty to more people and relieve people of worrying about it for a longer period of time. The other modification is on the first, the line 31 on the front page, and then continues on the second page. It basically says that if a condition is granted for an excuse, that it could be a permanent excuse. So I've had a couple of citizens in my district who said, gee, I asked to be relieved of my jury responsibilities because of some physical ailments or whatever it might be, and on the rotation, I get called up just coincidentally on a random situation, and I have to go state my case once again why I can't do it. It hasn't changed from 2 years or 4 years prior to that. So It's just to help clarify so people, once they've made their argument why they can't serve, and it's a legitimate one, that they should then be permanently removed from that master's jurors list.
Thank you, Representative Repine. Before we go any further in the proceedings, we'd like to welcome to our committee meeting some students from Austria. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And we'd like to extend a warm welcome to you. This is an example for you of the American legislative process at the state level. We're discussing a bill that would exempt everyone of 70 years or older from jury duty in our judicial system. We have 12-person jury trials and 6-person jury trials for criminals and civil matters. And we're simply saying that if you're 70 years or older, you could excuse yourself from having to come and participate in that judicial proceeding. So we're like to extend a warm welcome to you. And
Mr. Chairman,
Parks out of here before you ask
I want to ask
Representative Miller, the Representative Mannix.
Well, maybe I'll ask Representative Markham as long as he's on the bill. But also let me add a welcome to that group of students there here in connection with the Lake Ridge High School program. And I had the privilege of speaking to them just prior to coming into here, Mr. Chairman.
I think I'll recover from that now.
It seems to have gotten over it.
A question that I had for Judge Parks before he took off. He mentioned a number of citizens, I guess, come in and serve on juries that are over age 70, and I subscribe to the view that there is a great deal of utility and wisdom in people of that age category. I'm wondering whether or not any consideration has been given to, you know, what may be, gee, I don't want to go through the hassle of this. There may not be a big lineup to go down and demand you still stay on the jury roster. And maybe if you had the opportunity to get off, you might. And would we lose? Do we put ourselves in jeopardy of losing the experience and wisdom of those who are over 70?
Only if they don't want to come.
Well, I understand that. And I just, you know.
Representative Markin,
was that a question to me, Representative Miller?
Yes. Well, it was for Judge Parks, but since he took off, anyone who wants to take a, well, maybe you don't.
Representative Markin may not realize that Judge Parks is Representative Parks. We just whimsically refer to him as Judge Parks on the committee.
And I picked up on that, too, Representative Miller.
Yes, we have other.
Certainly, there are, in view of the fact I'm approaching that age myself, Representative Miller, there's great wisdom out there. But if my neighbor, who doesn't, is perhaps infirm and doesn't wish to come out and say, well, they don't hear too good, as the judge mentioned, or don't see too well, or tend to sleep when they're in the jury, which I'm sure is a concern to some of you folks that are in court, they should have that option to get out. And I don't think it's going to be a big draw against the pool. And what was that fellow's name I had,
Bill Linden.
When he agreed with me, he deals in it daily, I guess, why I felt pretty good about the bill. And he could not be here unless he's made it. And he told me to say that the bill was all right with his outfit.
Thank you.
Mr. Mannix.
Well, actually, I wanted to welcome our friends from Austria. And, I feel a particular affinity because my wife was born in a U.S. Army hospital in Salzburg, Austria, in 1952. And we had a chance to go back there and visit a couple of years ago.
Oh, the governor.
I'd also like to explain to our visitors, since they probably have never seen a committee meeting before, no, we do not normally eat our lunch at committee meetings, but today I haven't had a chance, and I won't have a chance all day, so that's why.
Some of us get our lunch handed to us at committee meetings. We're not eating.
Anyway, welcome.
Are you done with us, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Repine, do you have a response, retort, or otherwise a further comment?
Absolutely. I haven't been asked any questions, so I'm just kind of sitting here
waiting
for that.
Oh, waiting for a question.
Glorious.
You don't want to be caught holding your breath in this committee.
Glorious
either.
Opportunity. I've only read about this committee. I've never had the pleasure of sitting in front of this.
Well, most of the stuff on the floor comes from here, so now you see the source of all the trouble.
Perhaps in view of that, Representative Repine could compare the English, the Austrian, and the American jurist system to give us some sort of comparison.
I really could. I actually studied that in college, but there's probably not enough hours today to do that. But
you could submit that in writing by 5 o'clock.
I think Mr. Chair.
Well, the public clock is running.
I think they
why don't we go ahead and move on to...
Chair Markham over here.
I was going to comment. I think they hang them higher in Australia. Although this is not the criminal side, is it? I'm sorry.
The other side of the globe there.
We.
I know.
Mr. Chairman, now, if now nothing else, he made a valid point about, you know, when they get up to that age. Yeah.
Rep think his bill's going to go for it.
Representative Markham's always been like that. It has nothing to do with his age.
Okay, we appreciate that. We'll say goodbye to you from the Hang'em High Committee, Representative Repine. Let's go ahead now. The sentiment of the chair is to move right into the work session of House Bill 2837. Let's open up a work session, House Bill 2837.
Chairman.
Representative Millock.
Move 2837, House Bill 2837 to the full committee with due pass recommendation.
Representative Miller moves House Bill 2837 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Good bill should pass.
We've heard a lot of that, so let's go ahead and call the roll, please.
Aye.
Clark?
Excuse.
Edmondson?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Manning?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Bell?
Aye.
Charbonne?
Votes yes. House Bill 2837 have received appropriate majority vote. Is forwarded to the full committee to do pass recommendation. Volunteers as carriers of this one?
Sure. Many of them probably.
Representative Johnson?
Okay.
To the full committee, thank you. Close the work session on House Bill 2837. You look like an Australian anyway.
Thank you.
Sure, anytime. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing. 2780. We're going to go ahead and... any witnesses here to testify on House Bill 2780 besides Representative Repine, who left? Go ahead. We probably have a list here. No, we don't. Instead, go ahead and come on up, and if you would be good enough to identify yourself.
Thank you. My name is Monty Bricker. I'm a lawyer practicing in Portland, and I'm representing today the Judicial Administration Committee of the Oregon State Bar. The Judicial Administration Committee has no objection to House Bill 2780. I called yesterday Judge Donald Launder, the presiding judge of Multnomah County. He has no objection either. He informed me that since they've gone to the driver's rolls, there's a large pool of jurors in Multnomah County. I also called the State Judicial Administrator's Office yesterday. They have a problem with the bill with regard to what it does to the size of the pool. This bill will increase the amount of time between the time you're required to serve as a juror from the present 24 months to 48 months. You have a four-year hiatus rather than a two-year hiatus. The bill, the statute, was changed in 1985, moving it from a one-year hiatus to a two-year hiatus. That was in line with the American Bar Association's recommendations and guidelines, and in line with the federal court's guidelines. Federal court has a two-year pool. In this state, in some counties, jurors serve as long as 3 months. In my county, in Multnomah County, they only serve for 2 weeks. The State Judicial Administrator's Office informed me yesterday they're trying to reduce the inconvenience to those jurors who serve as long as 3 months. They'd like to reduce it to 2 months or 1 month or 2 weeks. To do this, they'll need a larger pool of people. This bill reduces the pool of people, and that's why they have a problem with it. And I told them that I would bring that before this committee. It seems to me an area of compromise might be to simply study how this bill affects each of the individual counties to see if it does cause, in fact, some inconvenience in the various counties. But so far as my committee is concerned, the Judicial Administration Committee, we have no objection to the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bryan.
Thank you. Sir, you mentioned Multnomah County has a two-week impoundment.
Yes.
And even at that fairly rapid or short term, the presiding judge doesn't have a difficulty going to 48-month rotation.
That's exactly what he represented to me yesterday.
It, of course, raises the point in my mind, obviously, if those counties that might be on a 1, 2, or 3 month basis, how they can have such a pool problem if on a two-week basis, Multnomah County does not.
I don't know how much study, if any, has been done in Multnomah County. I called the judge, picked him up on the telephone in between conferences, and he said that he didn't have any problem with it. That's why I think that it might make some sense to study the bill in with the individual counties. Certainly it disturbs the Judicial Administration Office, the State Judicial Administrator.
Thank you.
Learned, counsel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bryan, you have in your packet of materials prepared testimony from the State Court Administrator, and one of his comments is that he believes that the first section of the bill, the one extending the time between service from 2 to 4 years, would be causing the most substantial problem in the counties with smaller populations.
If I may, I did find a note on my desk this morning after having talked to that office yesterday that they have no objection to Section 2, the second part of the bill, that is, excusing jurors permanently. It's only Section 1 that troubles them.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Representative.
Is there anyone else who wished to testify on House Bill 2780? Kingsley?
For the record, I'm Kingsley Click, Deputy State Court Administrator. Bill Linden's unable to be here. He submitted some testimony before you. I think that Monty Bricker went over most of the issues that we were concerned about. It wouldn't be I guess I would characterize it, if you change the ineligibility period extended, it wouldn't be a fatal change in our opinion. We just did have concerns because the longer the ineligibility period, the more administrative problems that occurred in trying to verify previous service. And I've set that out kind of in the testimony. The only substantive issue, though we don't have any empirical data, is the one about reducing the overall quality of the jury pool and maybe getting into some problems with representativeness and inclusiveness of the population. But if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I did have one clarification. We do have different terms of service throughout the different counties. As Mr. Bricker mentioned, it's 2 weeks in Multnomah, and some places a month, and others 3 months. But under the statutes, the maximum length of time any one juror can serve, with no matter what their term that they're on call, is 10 days or the end of the trial that they're sitting on the 10th day. So that's just clarification.
Thank you. Further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any further witnesses on House Bill 2780? What's the sense of the committee on this bill? We have some concerns about some rural areas. Representative Bryan.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the thought that I would look to the members from the less populated counties to tell us what they think, because that seems to be where the problem is, and maybe some of the members who practice in those areas have a better feel for that. It doesn't appear to be a problem in the more populated counties. So.
Why don't we check into this a little bit? We've passed out the 70 and older bill, which is a good thing, I think, all the way across. We'll just hold this bill over for either a subsequent public hearing or work session. I won't be moving ahead with it. It's always nice to have candidate for Attorney General come visit us. Well, move right along. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2780. Go ahead and
for half an hour to say that.
Open up. It's instantaneous, Representative.
Which
Clark.
One of us are you talking?
It doesn't matter to me.
There you go.
Representative Bell, do you have something to tell us?
Representative
Bryan, would you like to join
inside the room, there was at least, potentially with nameplates, three potential candidates. It's not counting the chair or the super chair, and that was it. Let's go ahead and open
change
up a...
Change having to be a lawyer. You don't have to be. You don't?
Oh.
You're the teller in the red. Throw my hat right here.
Senate Bill 427. We're going to ask James Speakerman, thank you, and we have that, and we're asked staff to bring us up to speed quickly on this issue, and we'll move right ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 427 is the Oregon State Bar's bill revising its organic legislation. The major policy choices before the committee are whether to prohibit attorneys from practicing as business corporations and whether to eliminate the statutory requirement to keep client secrets secret. In your materials, you have a copy of the Senate vote. It was 21-8, a copy of the disciplinary rule on keeping client secrets, a copy of the Oregon Evidence Code section on the attorney-client privilege, a copy of the section from the Business Corporation Act regarding shareholder liability, and a series of position papers from the Oregon State Bar on issues that were raised in the hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
And apparently, as you always dutifully point out, we had 21-8 vote on the Senate floor.
And an interesting mix of no votes.
An interesting mix of no votes with Democrats, Republicans crossing the lines. Cats and dogs sleeping together. Go ahead. Mr. Pickleman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, committee members. When this was in the Senate, there was a portion in it that we didn't think was controversial, but turned out to be, having to do with the lawyer trust account overdraft notice. That has been removed. The bill now is primarily a bill dealing with housekeeping and technical matters. We really don't think there are any controversial issues. And I don't propose to go through the bill section by section. We are here, however, to answer any questions that any of the members may have. And with me today, I'm chair of the Public Affairs Committee of the Oregon Board of Governors. And with me is my lawyer, George Reamer, who's general counsel of the Oregon State Bar, and Bob Frazier, who is president of the Oregon State Bar. And we would be glad to answer any questions that anyone has.
Why don't you go ahead and give us, set us some light on why there was 8 no votes, mostly members of the Oregon State Bar and a few others who voted no on this bill, Jim Hill and Ron Grinsky. And well, that might be true, too, I guess. That's always a plausible explanation. Could you give us some kind of indication of what their problem was with the bill?
I can't. I thought the only problem was with the trusted draft overdraft notification portion, which was removed. There were some questions originally asked about when we testified about several portions of the bill, and we provided written information on that, and I was not aware that there was still a problem. One of the areas mentioned is maybe a talked about the professional corporations portion of the bill. There is another bill not being proposed by the bar and not on which the bar is not taking a position, having to do with the vicarious liability portions of the Professional Corporations Act. But we are not dealing with that. All we're saying is, in this, is that if you are a lawyer and you are going to incorporate, you should do so under the Professional Corporations Act, not the Business Corporations.
doing so much. But we don't honor that. The bar disciplinary statute says that I can be disbarred for willful violation of that provision. We don't. I mean, that is a lie. That's not the way the world works, is it? I mean, we don't even have comprehensive pro bono requirements for lawyers in this state. So how can that statute be on the books?
Well, I think over the last few years, we've attempted to take a look at this statute, 9.460, and I think Representative Mannix is correct. This is really from the original DD code, and it really is, it needs modernization, and in a particular like the one on the confidences, where there could be an inconsistency, we want one clear standard. That's a troubling provision, exactly what it's intended to mean, the scope. And I am very concerned about having disciplinary standards that are not enforceable or enforced. So I sympathize with what you're saying, that technically if somebody isn't doing what somebody says they should be doing as far as pro bono and it is deemed to be willful, that could result in a disciplinary sanction. And I don't know that that's the best approach to that problem. I don't have a better response than that.
I love the statement as an aspirational standard.
It's, I agree. But whether it should be in the disciplinary statute, I doubt.
Thank you, Representative Clark. We appreciate that. You can add a penalty to that clause later if it ever gets to work session. But don't hold your breath.
Five years in prison.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
My
question was on the same language. You could suggest that particularly those who were in this committee or lawyers hear about the cause of the oppressed on a daily basis. And I guess maybe we're in deep trouble if we ever reject those pleas, and perhaps some would argue we might, and we do on occasion. And I guess I'm a little uncomfortable with that language being in there myself. And also maybe even that may not be the only language in that particular section that causes some concern. But Representative Clark, I guess, raised it, and we may need to massage this a little bit.
We need to move on to other bills. So, Mr. Max, a brief question or comment?
Well, I was going to ask them to comment on that. It seemed to me that that proposal, this section, really simply codifies the age-old concept exemplified by John Adams defending the British soldiers in Boston in the Boston Massacre, that you're willing to step forward without, says personal consideration, without looking at your own personal interests in upholding the cause of the defenseless or the oppressed. It doesn't mean that you have to go out and hang up a shingle and say that that's your line of practice or that you're going to take pro bono work. It just says that you shouldn't be looking to your personal interests in the defense of others. That's the way I read it.
Thank you, Representative Mannix. We appreciate that. The chair does not intend to hold a work session on this today, and that situation might change in the future. This has interesting relating clause, and there's problems mentioned throughout this committee meeting, as well as Section 9, which the chair considers to be a major obstacle to the moving of this bill. Until that's changed and other things happen on the bill, I do not intend to have a work session, so members will be aware of that. We're going to close a work session on Senate Bill 427.
I close the hearing as well.
Yeah, close the hearing, too. Public hearing. Take care of that. We're going to open up a work session on House Bill 3349. We'll bring up Mr. Hansen, Fred Hansen. Would you please come up? And we would appreciate you letting us know the position of the department on this particular bill, and then we're going to have Mr. Bronner come up after you briefly, and then we probably will be working the bill sometime. And I notice you've got some folks with you, so go ahead and identify yourself, if you would, identify your colleagues, and we'll proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Fred Hansen, Director, Department of Environmental Quality. With me is Mike Downs, who is the administrator of the Environmental Cleanup Division within the department that handles much of the issues that are at hand here. and also Larry Edelman, who is from the Attorney General's Office, Assistant Attorney General assigned to the department to work these issues. Chairman, what I'd like to do is, if I may, is just take a moment to be able to deal a little bit with the history of what the federal law is and the state law and why we're in the situation we are. Number two, to be able to address specifically the issues that that are pending at the federal level and that this would anticipate. Third, to express what is our strong desire, and then fourth, to express specific concerns relative to the bill itself, but in that order. In 1980, the Congress passed what is known as CERCLA, the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, shorthand known as Superfund. That legislation established strict liability for all parties connected with contaminated sites. That meant that owners and operators at the time of the release of a hazardous substance were held liable. Owners and operators subsequent to the release, who reasonably should have known of the release prior to the ownership or the operation, are held strictly liable. Generators who sent hazardous substances to the site are strictly liable. And transporters who transported the hazardous substance to the site, strictly liable. Lastly, and the issue that, of course, is being addressed here, are that lenders who participated in the management of the site as an effective operator or de facto operator were also held to be liable, although explicitly within that statute that if there was merely an issue of a security interest, that that liability, at least in the federal law, not intended. Specifically, the Environmental Protection Agency was charged with making responsible parties clean up sites. They did that first by using their enforcement authorities of requirement, and then lastly, if not to actually use the fund, that is the fund created by a charge on petroleum products throughout the United States. Not only can EPA exercise these authorities, but third parties may also, if they have in fact incurred liability, that they may in fact seek under third party actions to be able to exercise that same strict liability. Congress, in the goal, wanted to be able to create a very broad net of potentially liable parties and to ensure that there were strong incentives for all people involved in hazardous materials, whether they were owners, operators, transporters, generators, and lenders, to be very careful in how one handled hazardous waste and hazardous materials. And that certainly has been effective. In 1987, the Oregon legislature enacted House Bill 1 or Senate Bill 122. At the time of that enactment of the so-called state Superfund law, it was very clear that an effort was underway to ensure that we had as closely as possible parallel language to the federal law. The goal, of course, was to ensure that any entity was not subject to one set of laws at the federal level, but another set of laws at the state level, or that those differences across state borders would also potentially cause problems. Currently pending at the federal level are two laws introduced on the House side, Representative LaFalce, and on the Senate side, Senator Garn's bill, to be able to address the issue of lender liability. Those pieces of legislation, Frank Bronner, I think, can best speak to whether they are likely to be able to be enacted or not, but that those pieces are being contemplated at the federal level. In addition to that, the Environmental Protection Agency has what is called an interpretive guidance in the form of a rule, administrative rule, to interpret under their abilities what liability will extend to lenders. That interpretive guideline is currently being reviewed at the Office of Management and Budget. We understand that there is movement on it there and that we would hope, though, that there would be that issued very soon. Specifically, the concern that the Department of Environmental Quality has goes back to that parallel issue that we have had since the original enactment of the state Superfund law. And that is, we strongly support the concept that the state law be parallel to the federal law. and that if we had our druthers, that what would happen is upon enactment of any changes in the federal law, whether it be administrative rule or actual new statute, that we were able to immediately say ditto and have that reflection, because we believe that that is very important. We are also sympathetic to the issue that the bankers raise in relationship to lender liability, but I'd like to point out several items about it. First off is that as long as the federal law is in existence, that that liability that is incurred under federal law is able to be applied to any Oregon setting, whether or not state law has been changed or is parallel to that federal law. That happens in one of two areas, either in the fact that third parties may bring action under the federal law and have that that level of liability established by federal law apply, or secondly, the state or EPA on their own could go through federal law and assert that same level of liability. Seems to me that what's at issue is if the law that's being proposed or something similar passed, what would happen differently in Oregon pending any action by the federal government. I met with a number of us met with representatives from the Oregon Bankers Association yesterday afternoon to be able to discuss this very issue. With the specter of the federal liability still remaining the same, the answer was that little, if any, differences would take place in Oregon activities in relationship to whether or not bankers would or other lenders would take actions under what ways they could assert their protections for lender liability and controls, they believing that they would not, under the specter of an existing federal law, take any actions different from what they would today, even though state law might authorize them to do so because of the concern that under federal law they would still be held liable. In response to the question about whether or not they would lend to different people, the answer was maybe less certain but still quite strong, and that is that as long as federal liability still existed, that there would not be a difference. As a result, as we look at this issue and recognize our strong desire for parallelism with the federal law, we believe that the best course of action would be to craft legislation authorizing the Environmental Quality Commission to be able to establish upon any federal action regulations that would allow us to be able to remain parallel with that federal law. Let me go to the bill itself. If the desire of the committee is to be able to proceed with the legislation as opposed to what we would suggest, we obviously, of course, would be happy to work with the committee or with OBA to work out that language. But currently, we believe that the language that is before you in the legislation, 3349, is substantially broader than would be intended. And we believe that it would allow for sham efforts at being able to establish legally protective settings that really would not be intended by the sponsors of the legislation, but could be permitted under the language of the legislation. Specifically, maybe give you one example, and then I will be happy to answer any questions, is we are concerned that if, in fact, through a extension of credit or other type of similar extension of lender normal lender activity, that a structure could be established by which an operator could continue to operate and receive protection from liability when in fact both state and federal law would not intend such an activity or a protection of such an activity. It is certainly the possibility, as we review this law, that the opportunities go beyond normal traditional lending, and the liabilities that would be associated with it could come forward. And we do not believe that it makes sense to be able to encourage that type of sham activity, and would certainly want to, if the law were to go forward, to work toward narrowing those concerns. Thank you. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Mr. Johnson. Why don't we hold off? Would you mind if we wait until we ask the other two gentlemen? Do you have things to add? Is it Mr.
Dallas, Mr. Edelton. Nothing to add? Okay, well, why don't we go ahead then, Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fred, you made the comment in explaining the federal CERCLA provision that with regard to liability, it would only apply to lenders who were participants in management, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bryan, that is certainly the intent. There are a mixture of cases, both in the 11th Circuit and 9th Circuit, that have addressed that issue in different fashions.
Right. Mr. Chairman, further question. My question is in the area of what does the phrase participant in management mean? Because my recollection of the proponent testimony was if a lender took back a piece of property and was operating it, they aren't denying the liability exposure because they're operating it, but don't want to be liable for the operation of it where they're not participating. I mean, they make the loan, but they're not out there inspecting the property that they've loaned on or the business that they've loaned on, and they don't want to be liable for that. So I guess what I'm saying is my understanding of the proponents was the bill is trying to get at limiting liability, strict liability, where they are not in management or not participating in management, but simply lenders.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bryan, the issue is certainly that House Bill 3349, as we talk with the sponsors, attempt to be able to make sure that the direct lender, traditional lender responsibilities may be exercised without incurring liability. Two things. One is that in relationship to the legislation as written in 3349, we believe that it is broader than that and would allow for people to take on non-traditional lending activities, but under the guise of being the lender, escape liability as provided. We would want to, at minimum, narrow that. However, under the federal law, in the court cases, and again, Mr. Edelman is here and can speak to specifically to it, but let me just maybe summarize briefly. The so-called, one of the cases that I think is of concern is the Fleet Factors decision out of the 11th Circuit, which indicated that if one had the capability of exercising management responsibility or exercised financial control, that they might be held liable. In a case that is here that came from Oregon out of the 9th Circuit, though, the Bergso case, explicitly they indicated that the lender must have exerted actual control before incurring liability. We believe, generally speaking, and I think most people do across the nation, that the 9th Circuit will be the controlling approach to that issue. But again, for full resolution, must be done at the federal statutory level, we believe.
Okay. Sure. Could you just point out where in the bill you feel the door is open for the lenders to go beyond the area we've been discussing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bryan, there are a number of areas, but let me give you an example, and we can go from that if you would like. If one would turn to Section 3 of the law. Section 3.1a, line 29, beginning at line 29, basically says that the lender shall be liable under existing law for the release in which the lender holds a security interest or which the lender holds, controls, or manages pursuant to the terms of an extension of credit. Now, that is modified later in lines 34 and 35 and 36. That is, the extension of liability protection is if you are extending any form of credit. It is then modified by the lines 34 and 35, which is that you are not allowed to if there are that the lender's acts or omissions contribute to remedial action costs or damages. Goes on to be able to talk about, I'm reading the wrong spot.
It's on the next page.
Right, in the next page.
Section 4.
Subsection 4. pardon me, on lines 11 and 12, that this is the exception, I jumped to the wrong spot, that nothing in this subsection of this, of subsection 1, shall relieve a lender from liability arising out of a release of a facility if the lender and then had actual knowledge or by any act or omission. What it does is it short those two exceptions. If there are other activities that a lender may be involved in that are really operational, that are in fact operating a facility in a normal business-like fashion, where anyone else who were doing that would be held liable if they are under the lender test but do not fail the two requirements on 4 sub A or B or C, that they would not be held liable. That is not, as we have talked with the financial institutions, not the intent, but clearly, in our view, what the law as proposed would do.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Appreciate you, other folks, for coming up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Williamson, would you like to come up and...
Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Charles Williamson, representing the Oregon Trialers Association. We are concerned not simply with the environmental cleanup aspects of this bill, but primarily with the fact that the bill goes beyond simply a partial repeal of the Superfund law, but goes into giving the banks exemptions from strict liability and negligence under traditional tort law, under which, as far as we know, they were never held liable before the passage of the CERCLA or the state CERCLA laws. In that sense, this is yet another bill in the long line of bills before this legislature seeking special treatment for special interests in this session. The the bill exempts banks from from liability for personal injuries they may cause to others through release of hazardous chemicals or other substances when they take back a business and are, in fact, operating it. I believe that under the section when it says they're not liable when they're acting as other than a lender, they still see themselves as operating as a lender after they repossess a business and they're operating it in the course of selling it. So that if they've got an operating business, there's a hazardous substance release that causes injury to property or an individual, this bill would exempt them, not just under CERCLA, but from their traditional strict liability and tort for dealing with the hazardous substances. It also, if the bank takes back property and wishes to clean up the property, they are exempt from their own negligence in the cleanup for personal injuries to anyone or for property damages. As I say, our main concern is not with the CERCLA or the other environmental aspects of the bill, although I think our members, as a practical matter, are concerned, but in our sphere of concern for what our organization is doing down here, they are very concerned about the impact of this bill on the tort system. I think Mr. Hansen mentioned the actual knowledge, but the actual knowledge test is a very tough test to meet. If you just look the other way and you don't actually know something, but you had some reason to inquire further, but you don't want to inquire further because then you get some liability. The actual knowledge test is a tough test on line 13 of page 4. The bill gives the bank some pretty special treatment in the tort system, and we would urge that it not be passed.
Chair.
Representative Clark.
Charlie, I'm trying to read what you're saying to us here. There are times that you come in front of us and you say no way, no how. And you mean it, and then there are times that you come in front of us and you say no way, no how, and then we draft some amendments and you say, well, that's okay, that makes it better. And I'm trying to figure out whether this is the first situation or the second situation. If you had actual knowledge or reason to know, I mean, which might cause somebody else to fall off the bill on the one hand, but I'm trying to get some sense for what you're saying to us.
The bankers were kind enough to buy me lunch yesterday, and we spent an hour or more going over this. And I mean, I see that they are acting in good faith, and they have a legitimate concern that they can't lend money now for cleanups, or they can't make loans where they otherwise would be able to. I have clients also who say, but you know, they won't lend money to anybody unless they don't need the loan. But I think the bankers genuinely do feel that if they could address the problem here, they could fund more cleanups and fund more purchases of property and clean up more property. And I understand their problem, but I really don't think I guess our organization truly does not feel that they should go beyond that they should get special treatment under the traditional tort law, under which they were never held liable. I mean, they don't have any case where they were held liable.
Traditional tort law or the federal statute?
The federal statute, I think we're, you know, if we took a vote of our organization, they'd probably side with Osberg and so forth, but I'm not sure that they feel particularly strongly. I mean, just the CERCLA aspects of it, I think they probably would be on the side of the DEQ and trying to work out something for the